This is Black Agenda Radio, a weekly hour of African American political thought and action.
Welcome to the radio magazine that brings you news, commentary, and analysis from a Black left perspective. I'm Glenn Ford, along with my co-host, Nellie Bailey. Coming up, a Black historian reports on how U.S. banks stole the resources and sovereignty of whole nations in the Caribbean and Latin America. A new book explores the political culture spawned by the radical movements of the 60s and 70s. And supporters of Mumia Abu-Jamal believe upcoming hearings provide a real chance of freedom for the nation's best-known political prisoner.
But first, the Black is Back Coalition for Social Justice, Peace, and Reparations recently held a national conference in St. Louis. The theme of the gathering was, "There is no peace. Africa and Africans are at war." Black is Back Chairman Omali Yeshetela told the audience,
"Africans are in a permanent state of warfare, and we think that it's a critical moment because the whole imperialist system is in a state of severe crisis. You can see it all around you. Many people don't understand exactly what they're seeing, but they know that they've never seen anything like this before. On every front, the split within the ruling class itself, the split within even the Trump administration, split. What Trump says one thing and the state does another thing. You ever seen that? Yeah. Trump says the Russians are cool, and then the state apparatus goes and say, we're putting more sanctions on the Russians. Trump said, I want to get along with North Korea. And the vice president said, we're going to do North Korea just like we did Gaddafi and Libya and what have you, to bust up all of that. And so you got splits there. You got splits between the United States and other powers. You got them trying to overturn all the trade relationships that existed among the imperialist powers for 70 years. And part of that is because everywhere around the world, peoples around the world are struggling to take back their freedom, take back their resources, and that's making the pie shrink for the imperialist forces. And so there is no honor among these thieves. Yeah. And so now they're fighting against each other. The Brexit, with England leaving the European Union, Italy is on the verge of splitting away from it. So crisis abounds everywhere. And that's notwithstanding all of the stuff that they're trying to do to our people in Venezuela. You see the war being made against Venezuela. You see the war that's been made against Nicaragua. All around the world, they're trying to reverse their fortunes, but the people are in motion, and there is no retreat. We will win this one, or we will perish. We say, Black is back, damn it. Black is back. Uhuru.
That was Omali Yeshetela speaking to a conference of the Black is Back Coalition in St. Louis.
President Donald Trump angered much of the world when he called nations in the Caribbean and Africa feces holes. In an article for Black Agenda Report, historian Peter James Hudson pointed out that U.S. banks played a key role in making countries in the Caribbean, Latin America, and Africa into places of poverty and oppression. Hudson is author of the book, Bankers of Empire, How Wall Street Colonized the Caribbean.
The key to the article that I wrote for Barr and my kind of use of Trump's comments about Haiti and a number of countries in Africa was to think through the relationship between capitalism and white supremacy in the imperial context. And for me, the kind of focus of that analysis was really through Wall Street, through the work of American banks in the early 20th century, like the J.P. Morgan Chase, the National City Bank of New York, which is now Citigroup, and other institutions. And what we see in the early 20th century in places like Haiti, in Cuba, in Nicaragua, in the Dominican Republic, in Panama, is not only the entrance of finance capital seeking profit at the expense of Caribbean sovereignty, but the justifications and the means and the modalities through which they enter into the Caribbean, approached through racial discourses through the lenses of white supremacy. And so one of my claims in the article is that we have to understand the expansion of imperialism into the Caribbean in terms of not just financial capital, but as in terms of racial capitalism. And what this means, referring back to Trump's comment, is on one level, you have these bankers, and I've done a lot of archival work on this, you have these bankers who see Haiti as backward, who see it as an atavistic place, who see it as a kind of instantiation of Africa in the tropics, poor, backward, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. At the same time, though, they're willing to use that backwardness to their own, or this, that perceived backwardness to their own ends to extract profit. And so there's a kind of paternalistic relationship there where bankers see Haiti and other places as places where their capital will be the kind of the guiding hand of white supremacy, leading these countries into the future, not the future that white people can get to, but a future just right behind white people that, you know, that where they can profit from. So Trump's comment was for me a kind of political screen for the fact that he was now getting rid of certain kind of immigration categories for Haitians. But it, for me, it had real echoes with the expansion of Wall Street into the Caribbean in the early 20th century.
And these bankers, styling themselves as the guiding hand of a racialized capitalism, you're not just reading that motivation into them. You actually produce documents in which, when talking among themselves, that is how they express themselves.
Absolutely. And I think this is important and something that can't be emphasized enough. And it's the kind of relationship between individual belief and institutional practices. And what I found in the kind of internal documents published by the banks, there is these newsletters that they would produce, magazines that they would produce for their employees, as well as the correspondence between individual bankers, between bankers in the State Department about Haiti, about Nicaragua, about Cuba, is a consistent use of racial language, or racist language, to be more explicit about this. This belief that the Indians of Nicaragua were uncivilized, the Africans of Haiti were uncivilized, black people were uncivilized, brown people were uncivilized. But it's one thing to say, well, okay, sure, early 20th century bankers, of course they had so-called racial attitudes. Of course they reflected the kind of discourses of the time. Every individual was to some degree racist. But what I try to argue is that those attitudes were basically instrumentalized into policy, that they were kind of transcribed into the actual loan agreements, transcribed into the memoranda of relations between the United States and Caribbean countries, transcribed into the actual financial practices that governed the relationships between Wall Street and the Caribbean. And in transcribing or inscribing that kind of racist language into the kind of documents of capitalism, they inscribed a kind of narrative, not just a narrative, but a practice of exploitation. If you saw these people as lesser than, you would treat them as lesser than, and then the kind of loan agreements and et cetera that you imposed on them would be strictly about deriving as much profit from these bodies as possible. Of course, there was pushback from some Caribbean elites or from Caribbean peasants, but overall, if you look at the history of Wall Street in the Caribbean, it is a history of straight exploitation that is based on kind of language and discourse of racial capitalism.
Well, yes, how did the elites in these various countries react to the clearly racist and imperial attitude of these bankers who were trying to take over the finances of their countries, noting that most of these elites were themselves white or thought of themselves as being white?
Well, and it's a great question. I think your latter point is really important, because many elites, many of the white elites in Cuba, but also, you know, many of the black elites in Haiti at the time, identified with Europe, identified with whiteness, would send their kids off to France to school, would send their kids to New York for school, and really believe that they were better than the Caribbean peasant or the Caribbean worker, especially the undereducated or uneducated dark-skinned workers. So that for many years, there was a really strong identification with whiteness. And so they believed that it was in their benefit to align with the white nations of Europe and the United States to effectively exploit their darker brethren and consolidate consolidate their positions of power. They're acting as a kind of traditional neo-colonial intermediary between the Caribbean and the United States, and exactly the way that Frantz Fanon describes it in The Wretched of the Earth, where these are people who basically are middlemen who facilitate the exploitation of their country's resources and workers, are able to kind of skim some cream off the top for themselves to consolidate their political power, but are at the end of the day used as conduits for the exportation of capital back to the United States or to Europe, or for the privileges of military access to Caribbean waters and other Caribbean sites. There's a moment, though, towards the end of the middle of the 1920s and then into the 1930s, where the kind of emergence of the global financial crisis sparked by the crash of October 1929 throws these elites into a little bit of confusion. And in Haiti, this is also exacerbated by the context of the U.S. military occupation, which begins in 1915. The U.S. military occupation makes the Haitian elite realize, well, you know what? We are not white. We are not European. That maybe our interests actually do lie with the peasantry. The U.S. imports modes of American segregation and American racism that push the elite to the fringes of their own society. In many cases, the U.S. officers are upset when the black Haitian elite are trying to dance with the white wives of these officers. There's one instance where I think it's General Smedley Butler, who's a Marine commander, a very well-known Marine commander, who literally throws a Haitian member of the Haitian elite off his horse and kind of humiliates him in front of his peers. And it's these kind of constant acts of humiliation that turn the elite in some ways away from Europe, away from complicity in the United States occupation forces, and towards Africa, towards the Haitian peasant. And then going back to my original point, once the great crash happens in 1929, you see a kind of crisis throughout the Caribbean in terms of relationships to the United States and in the Anglophone Caribbean to Britain. There's suddenly a realization that this kind of history of Euro-American capitalism is not sustainable. The kind of cultural effects of that are alienating to Caribbean elites, that Wall Street is exploiting the Caribbean countries for their own good, and the elites are no longer benefiting from it in the ways that they thought they were. In many cases, the U.S. is supporting dictatorships, not just in the military occupation of Haiti, but through their alignment with Gerardo Machado in Cuba. And you begin to see that the elites then, one, sees political and economic power in their own hands. And in the case of Cuba, they try to repudiate the debts that have been imposed on the country over the past decade by the Chase Manhattan Bank. In the case of Haiti, they work to expel the U.S. occupation forces and negotiate the transfer of the Haitian National Bank from the Citibank, who's basically owned it since the late teens, and they try to reclaim it for their own interests. There's problems with this, in as much as, you know, for every kind of revolutionary action, there's a equal and opposite counter-revolutionary reaction. The attempts by Cuba to regain its sovereignty lead, not in a straight line, but importantly to the rise of the dictator Batista. In the case of Haiti, we see the Haitian government is able to purchase the Haitian National Bank, but its directors and the control of the bank still remains in Wall Street. And we also see that the kind of reclamation of Africa in the Haiti leads to the most kind of egregious forms of racial nationalism and political control that eventually emerge with the rise of François Duvalier dictatorship.
And of course, this whole saga comes to an end in one country, Cuba, of course, in 1959. And Cuba began its existence as a independent or semi-independent state with U.S. military occupation, followed very soon by penetration by these banks. And in fact, the military occupations and the banking penetration often went hand in hand.
Absolutely. And I think it's important to realize that when Fidel Castro came to power in 1959, one of the first things that he tried to do was expel the American bankers and to try to seize their assets and nationalize the banks with Che Guevara as finance minister. The difficulty they had with that was the fact that Citibank in particular had a previous experience with attempts by sovereign states to seize their so-called assets in 1917 during the Russian Revolution, when they had just entered into Russia and began setting up a branch bank network. And when Lenin came to power and the Soviet Union was formed, they took over the American banks. And so they lost, I don't know the exact figure, but I think millions of dollars. And so they were well prepared for the Cuban Revolution when that happened, in terms of having previously transferred assets outside of the country. But you also see, going back to the second part of your comment, soon after the U.S. intervenes, basically the Cuban conflict against Spain, and defeat the Spanish and begin lifting the U.S. flag in Cuba in 1898, U.S. Capital is immediately there. The U.S. Capital is already beginning to enter the country in a serious way. The middle of the 19th century, business interests in Boston, Philadelphia, New York, and New Orleans are becoming heavily involved in sugar and other interests. But after 1898, you see the first definitive moment of the entrance of Wall Street and American bankers. The first U.S. bank to set up in Cuba is in Santiago de Cuba in July 1898. It's a company called the North American Trust Company. And they're an interesting company because their principals had made their money from their work and the kind of financing of settler colonialism in the U.S. West from 1873 to about 1893. The crisis of 1893 collapsed their operations in the West. Samuel Miller Jarvis to New York, where he formed the North American Company and then North American Trust Company. And then the moment he realized that the U.S. flag was going to be raised in Cuba, he quickly chartered a boat over there and set up banks first in Santiago and then later in Havana. And his first operations was to kind of provide financial services for the U.S. military. But using his connections to President McKinley, he tried to secure accounts for basically the kind of emerging Cuban state. His trust company, the North American Trust Company, eventually, I guess in 1903, became the Banco Nacional de Cuba, which eventually became, even though it was privately run, Cuba's national bank. At one point, the interests of the bank were taken over by Cubans. So there's this interesting moment where the Cuban bourgeoisie is in control of this bank. But after a financial crisis based on the collapse of the price of sugar in 1920-21, the institution is taken over by North American interests, primarily the Citibank and the Royal Bank of Canada. So the main thing here, through this entire abbreviated history that I'm outlining here, is to understand that, returning to some of the kind of critiques that earlier historians had dismissed, was that you cannot look at U.S. colonialism in the Caribbean, or in Asia for that matter, without considering the explicit role that finance capital and Wall Street institutions had in maintaining it and extending it.
Now, this next question is outside the scope of your book. It takes us to the present, a time when U.S. capital has been eclipsed by Chinese capital. China's the biggest investor in Latin America as well as in Africa.
I think we're living through an interesting and kind of ongoing moment of crisis in global capitalism. And the scary and difficult part of crisis is that we never know what new forms will emerge from it. But what we've seen historically is it's financial crisis that can also lend itself to the emergence of new powers. And this is precisely what happened in the Caribbean during the 1920s, during the financial crisis in the 1920s that I mentioned in the 1930s. There's this moment of an opening. And I think what we're seeing right now is the United States hasn't recovered from the crisis of 2007. I think the structural elements that led to that crisis, you know, were probably seen as early as 1999 or 2000. And then the kind of cash grab that we're seeing on the part of the U.S. elites is, I think, really a moment when you're trying to recover as much from a burning house as possible. But at the same time, people have bought the land under the house. And I think that's exactly what's happening with China. I mean, China at this point is acting in Africa, but also in the Caribbean, as a kind of soft power, building, lending money for roads, building sports stadiums, this kind of thing. But I think this is really, I think in this case, the kind of expansion of finance capital in this world will probably be both an attempt to seize agricultural lands for the Chinese population, but also as a kind of foothold for the kind of Chinese military power that's going to need a foothold in these countries to maintain the kind of commercial and trade relations that China would like to have. For me, given that I'm a historian, this is all very, very speculative to some degree. But I think that we are really in the midst of a serious crisis. And we see this with the kind of ongoing problems of Wells Fargo's, the kind of collapse of Lehman Brothers, the recent revelations around the Royal Bank of Scotland and their kind of investments in the U.S. housing market, and the kind of ongoing difficulties despite kind of shareholder returns of the major American banks and other American corporations.
The radical movements of the 1960s and 70s produce a unique and compelling political culture, according to a new book titled Fugitive Life, The Queer Politics of the Prison State by Stephen Dillon. The book is featured in the Black Agenda Report Book Forum, edited by Roberto Servent. Stephen Dillon's work is rooted in the writings and actions of the hundreds of activists that tried to stay one step ahead of U.S. law enforcement 4 decades ago. Dillon says these activists produce a political culture of fugitivity.
The kind of knowledge that's produced by fugitives came from reading the long history of Black in prison writers. So like George Jackson and Malcolm X and Eldridge Cleaver all kind of insisted that there was particular insights and knowledge that came from people in prison, of course, that kind of positionality produced different ways of knowing the state and knowing about race and knowing about history and time. And so as I kept reading and thinking about that type of knowledge that came from imprisoned people, I started to think about what kind of knowledges might come from people who were running away, either before they were incarcerated or after they were incarcerated. And then I started reading the long history of fugitive writing and started seeing all sorts of theorizations of those same analytics, like history and time and gender and sexuality and the state and violence, coming from the space of fugitivity. There's this wonderful quote from the priest Daniel Berrigan after he was arrested for burning draft records in Ohio, and then he became a fugitive. He talked about how being a fugitive and being constantly on the run made him see power in a different way, because he started to see basically state violence everywhere, from the kind of smallest movements of the police or of someone on the street who's maybe looking at you a little funny, like maybe they recognize you, to really huge structures like U.S. imperialism or the history of anti-Blackness. The big thing I see a lot of fugitives in the 70s saying is that exactly that, that being a fugitive made them see just the everyday world really differently. David Gilbert, who worked with the Weather Underground and then a branch of the Black Liberation Army, said he started seeing people's shoes differently because he would look for the shoes that the FBI wore. He looked for haircuts. He looked for certain ways undercover agents might walk. So there was a way that being a fugitive kind of opened up these other ways of seeing how the state functions, where it operates, how it operates. And all of those things, unlike imprisoned people, the kind of philosophies or insights of imprisoned people come from constantly moving. So there's something really kind of foundational to the book and to the idea of fugitivity about just constantly moving.
You have some wonderful characters in this book, people that folks may have forgotten or never known about. One of them is Rita Bow Brown, who was called the gentleman bank robber, but she was no gentleman.
Yes, right. She was part of this group in Seattle called the George Jackson Brigade. They started after George Jackson was murdered. They were a group of multiracial, they were all former prisoners, so they were somewhat unique amongst the left in that they were all former prisoners. They were all working class. They were multiracial. A bunch of them identified as queer, and they kind of centered anti-racist and feminist politics in their underground work. And she was the group's bank robber. And she was known to rob banks. She dressed up in drag as a man, and she was tagged by Seattle newspapers as the gentleman bank robber because bank tellers praised her for her congeniality and politeness. So there was this interesting mix in her politics, but also that group's politics, where they were like really kind and gentle, to certain people, like a bank teller, she was polite. But then to the police or to the state or to prison bureaucracies or military installations, they were just absolutely ruthless. She's one of the kind of characters that I hope people dig more into. And there has been some more work about that group that's coming out.
Yes, the George Jackson Brigade was of 40 years ago, but their politics strike us as quite contemporary, in fact, especially in light of the Black Lives Matter movement and the prominence today of gays and lesbians in the movement.
Yeah, I think that's one of the other things I hope the book does is show people that there's a really long history of queer and feminist politics against anti-Blackness and white supremacy that kind of precede a conservative turn that happened in queer politics in the 1980s, where queer activists quite explicitly left behind queer people in prison and decided to go towards what they called winnable battles for marriage, for inclusion in the military, for inclusion in the police. So I think it's really important in this moment, as sometimes it's like, it's talked about in popular culture that something about queer politics mixing with anti-racist politics is new, like intersectionality is a new politics. And one of the things I hope the book does, along with other people are doing this work as well, but is to show that there's just absolutely nothing new about that politics, that it's very, very old. And it's actually older than, of course, even the 1970s or 1960s.
There was much talk back in those days, the late 60s and into the 70s, about fascism. But the circumstances of mass incarceration have actually gotten much worse since then.
Yes, that's one of the biggest kind of shifts in my own thinking I had as I was writing the book, is Angela Davis in the 1970s, while she was incarcerated, wrote this book called If They Come in the Morning. That was an edited collection of all these imprisoned Black radical activists and people who are supporting the campaign for her freedom, like James Baldwin. And all of the kind of authors in that collection wrote about how they thought fascism had arrived in the United States because 200,000 people were in prison, mostly people, you know, poor people of color. So they understood the kind of conditions of fascism to be really different than maybe our collective tolerance allows in this moment. And she has, in the present day, reflected back and said she just couldn't imagine in the 70s that there would be 2.5 million people in prison, you know, within 30 years. And that could happen without some formal fascist takeover of the government happening. That could actually happen under the kind of rubrics of democracy and equality and a kind of faux multiracialism, like under Obama. So yeah, there's many, many insights in the book also about how people were thinking about fascism in the 70s. It's only 30 years after fascism spread throughout Europe and the United States. And so I think there's something for us to think about what we tolerate. And people's tolerance in the 70s was perhaps much lower than ours.
Yes, and those underground activists that you focus on were addressing the question of disposability of Black people and others. And that was at the dawn of the neoliberal era, back before the welfare state had been effectively dismantled.
Yeah, exactly. So one of the kind of first things I started thinking about as I was reading all of this literature by activists was that it seemed like they almost saw what was coming. Like they knew that deindustrialization was coming. They knew the dismantling of the welfare state was coming. They knew an unprecedented regime of racialized capture was coming in the form of mass incarceration. And they actually saw it like 15 years before it really hit hard in the mid-1980s. So like books like Michelle Alexander's The New Jim Crow really focus on the 80s. And my book is trying to go back before things really hit their hardest to think about how activists were kind of, in a way, seeing what was coming.
You seem to be talking about a bunch of people who were in many ways prophetic.
Yeah, I think there's a prophetic quality to a lot of the writing that people like Assata Shakur and Angela Davis were doing, both from prison and from spaces of fugitivity, that as they were kind of theorizing the current conditions of the world, one of the chapters is about the connections between neoliberalism and contemporary prison and chattel slavery. So they were also both thinking about the current moment and the conditions that were changing, but also making connections between their present and the past. But in doing so, they also had this kind of prophetic vision of the future.
Yes, you write of a state that wanted to disappear political insurgents. Well, they've already disappeared from the corporate media. Much discussion of overthrowing capitalism, and now they seem to be coming for the internet and attempting to disappear all dissident thought and convert the internet into a place where you just chatter among friends about things of no consequence.
Yeah, exactly. There's all sorts of kind of repressive things happening around what you can publish and write and say on the internet. We've seen that with the kind of changing definitions of terrorism. So Obama declared Assata Shakur a terrorist and put her on the terror watch list. And then that had all sorts of implications about what sorts of things you could talk about on the internet about Shakur because she had been categorized as a terrorist. And similar things happened with underground environmental activists doing work with the Earth Liberation Front or underground activists doing work with the Animal Liberation Front. They were categorized as terrorism, as terrorists. And then that became a way to crack down on all sorts of websites that were used to spread information about them. One of the other things about what you're saying that the book does is try to show that activists in the 70s actually had both part of their prophetic quality was also that they were theorizing the prison and neoliberalism in the same way that's actually just completely mundane in the academy now. So all the kind of theorization of even by some mainstream sociologists or political scientists argue the purpose of the prison is to warehouse people or to dispose of Black people. That's kind of in most strains of critical prison studies scholarship right now, that's just like the starting point. But I saw, you know, activists like the George Jackson Brigade or Davis saying that 40 years ago, and there's not a recognition of that activist genealogy of thought. And so the book is also trying to make sure that we don't forget, like you were saying, don't forget about this legacy of knowledge that we have, but that is also sometimes being erased by the academy and scholars.
The prison state is central to this book. It's what these fugitives were fighting against. And as you said, some of them had been prisoners themselves. Does neoliberalism require the mass incarceration state?
Yes, absolutely. So one of the big arguments of the book is that kind of more mainstream or Marxist theories of neoliberalism say that the prison stepped in after neoliberalism started leaving people homeless and jobless, kind of desperate, and then the prison swept in to kind of be the other side of the coin of neoliberal freedom. What I saw in reading the writings of neoliberal economists starting in the 1930s to the 1970s, so again, before neoliberal economics really hit hard in the 70s, is that they were saying, so Milton Friedman was saying, that neoliberalism, a free market, required the prison. That to have the kind of free movement of capital, you had to make sure that rebellious or unruly or people who weren't going along with the program had to be contained in some capacity. So he said, in his language, law and order was necessary to the freedom of the market. So there's this actually much older genealogy of the relationship between neoliberal economics and incarceration. And I take that even further back by looking at how Assata Shakur and her writings about poor women of color, their experiences of poverty on the street, she talks about the market in the free world as functioning as a type of prison. So for her, the kind of very power of neoliberal economics and the free market is in of itself a form of incarceration. And that's something that's also echoed in the work of Stephanie Smollett, who's a scholar of slavery. She says that for enslaved people, the power of the market was that the entire world was a prison. So there's this much older relationship I'm trying to advance between neoliberal economics and incarceration. And yes, they both necessarily require each other.
I'm hearing echoes of the song, "The World is a Ghetto."
Yes, yes. And so many Black activists said that, you know, Malcolm X said that about the world is a prison. Matulu Shakur said the country is a prison. All sorts of activists in the 70s were theorizing not just the prison itself as a kind of isolated location for disposability or containment, but that its power made everywhere seem like a prison or feel like a prison or function as a prison.
In your interview for Black Agenda Book Review, you told Roberto Servent about a communique by the George Jackson Brigade back in 1977 when they said, if people want a better society, they can start by becoming active feminists, anti-racists, and anti-imperialists.
Yeah, that was one of the moments I was also just so excited when I found that communique because it really stood out. The way they emphasize the relationship between feminist and queer politics and fighting anti-blackness and colonialism and imperialism was pretty unique. That's something that other groups like the Black Liberation Army were not as explicit about, or even the Weather Underground. Those groups sometimes kind of subsumed gender or sexuality to their anti-imperialist or anti-racist politics. So the George Jackson Brigade, like other above-ground feminists of color in the 70s, like the Combahee River Collective, or there's a wonderful document called the Black Women's Manifesto that just precedes the George Jackson Brigade by 10 years. Those documents were all kind of advancing an argument about the centrality of anti-sexist and anti-homophobic politics to fighting anti-blackness and imperialism.
And again, 40 years later, we hear echoes of that political corrective today.
Yes, absolutely. I think that's something that the Black Lives Matter movement has, in its kind of inception, had a struggle over about how Black trans people or Black queer people would fit into the movement and how the murders of Black queer and trans people would fit into the agendas or vision of Black Lives Matter. And then I think over the last few years, we've seen a kind of reorientation or reimagining about what Black Lives Matter means, what it does, what its agenda should look like. Even the slogan like Black Trans Lives Matter was a way to modify or make visible Black trans people within the movement for Black lives.
Today, the prison population is far larger than back in the 70s, but we don't have as many, or certainly as many influential writers writing from a state of fugitivity.
Yeah, there's a pretty resounding silence. There are still many, many, many people who are fugitives, but we don't. In fact, a few people were just captured who were part of the Seminese Liberation Front. About 10 years ago, they found this woman named Sarah Olson, who was part of the Seminese Liberation Front. She was living in a suburb of Minneapolis, Minnesota, just as a suburban housewife. And they aired a segment about her work with the Seminese Liberation Front and Patty Hearst on America's Most Wanted, and a neighbor recognized her. And she was arrested after being a fugitive for 30 years. But people who are fugitives, there's not a culture around spreading the knowledge that they produce or that they might produce as fiercely as there was in the 70s. And the conditions of being able to capture fugitives have, of course, changed dramatically with things like the kind of just massive, massive surveillance state and facial recognition. And some people from the Weather Underground have just reflected back on they could not have stayed underground for 10 or 15 years in this current moment, just because the technology has changed. Like one thing they did, the Weather Underground bombed the U.S. Capitol, and they put a bomb in a bathroom, and the bomb didn't go off. So they went back a second time the next day and placed the second bomb on top of the first bomb inside the U.S. Capitol, and that bomb went off. So the two bombs exploded. But it's just unfathomable to think that you could walk in twice with a bomb in our current moment into the U.S. Capitol to do that. So the conditions for fugitives to be able to write or speak or be part of movements have also changed really drastically.
And we don't have many jailhouse authors either.
Yeah. And, you know, someone as prolific as Mumia, you know, is just constantly trying to be silent. His writing is often ignored by the mainstream press. So even the few precious voices we do have are not circulated.
That was Stephen Dillon, author of Fugitive Life, The Queer Politics of the Prison State.
This is the month of Black August, which always means increased efforts to free political prisoners in the U.S. The next days and weeks will see a flurry of activity to end the long incarceration of the nation's best-known political prisoner, Mumia Abu-Jamal. Ori Lumumba is a member of the MOVE family and of family and concerned friends of Mumia Abu-Jamal.
These hearings that's coming up for Mumia on August 30th are very important because this, in fact, could lead to a new trial for Mumia. And basically what's going on here is that all of the appeals that were denied, they would have to be reopened and listened to. And based on the evidence presented in these appeals, this, in fact, could, one, lead to a new trial for Mumia, which could lead to his release, or he could be released overall based on this. So this is very critical in the next step to save the life and free our brother, Mumia Abu-Jamal. So it is very important for people to come out on August 30th and show support for Mumia.
Do you have any indications that the judge who's presiding over these hearings is willing to upset the whole apple cart on the prosecutors?
Well, so far, I mean, this judge, he has set the bar. And, you know, he's, from what we didn't expect, he's actually doing. Now, the issue here is all of the files being turned over by Philadelphia District Attorney Larry Krasner. That seems to be the holdup here. And the judge keeps giving a timeline for the District Attorney's office to turn over all of these files, which hasn't been turned over yet. And this is been stretched out now for several months and still not resolved, but the evidence is there. It shows in these appeals, and this could lead to Mumia coming home.
Now, of course, Mumia's defense is charging bias by a judge who presided over some of his appeals who had previously been a prosecutor. But the man is a judge, and another judge has to make a judgment on that judge, and judges don't like to do that to each other often.
Often, right. Not often. I mean, all the time. It's like a brotherhood, sisterhood, where they all stick together. And basically, this man, Ronald Castile, he was once on the Pennsylvania Supreme Court, and he was asked to recuse himself from the appeal process for Mumia, which he refused. I mean, he was a prosecutor during Mumia's case. And not only that, but the crazy part was that he was voted Man of the Year by the Philadelphia Fraternal Order of Police, the same police union organization that has lobbied for Mumia to be executed and killed.
And in terms of the current prosecutor, Krasner, whom you mentioned, have Mumia's supporters been disappointed or heartened by his conduct since he was elected to office?
Well, I would say so. Krasner is seen as the shining light, the new progressive district attorney of Philadelphia who's against mass incarceration, who's against police misconduct, police brutality, and he has made great strides and great waves so far as district attorney. I mean, his, like, in the fight against mass incarceration in itself, he's touched on a lot of issues. He's cleaning up a lot of things. He's given light. But on this issue of Mumia, he's still been mum on the issue. And we know that's due to the pressure of the Fraternal Order of Police, who he's publicly feuded with for years, but this is the position here that's being taken. If you're going to do right, you have to do right across the board, not pick and choose on some issues, because this issue of Mumia has been going on since 1981, and it's time for it to end. So Krasner, if he doesn't want to do the right thing, which he's being pressured, it seems not to, then this worldwide movement is going to force him to do the right thing.
Well, Krasner is an elected official, and they are sensitive to the sentiments of masses of people. So how important is it that lots of people pile into Philadelphia on August 30th?
Oh, it's at the utmost importance and the utmost serious. What they call code red, an emergency. This is an emergency for the life of our brother Mumia Abu-Jamal, because Mumia is still gravely sick, suffering from hepatitis C. So the sooner we get this brother out so he could get the much-needed treatment that's required, the better it'll be. So that's why we have to continue to keep the pressure on this system over the issue of our brother Mumia Abu-Jamal, and to keep pressure on Philadelphia District Attorney Larry Krasner to release all the files in Mumia's case so that we can bring our brother home. We're saying enough is enough.
And of course, the Mu family is in solidarity with Mumia, just as Mumia has always been in solidarity with the Mu family.
Yes, sir. That's our brother. Mumia is our brother. On December 9th, 1981, when this government tried to assassinate Mumia in the street, the Mu organization's founder and coordinator, John Africa, sent Mu members to the hospital to check up on Mumia to make sure Mumia was okay. And John Africa said at that day right there, we have to do everything in our power to support our brother Mumia and show him the same loyalty that he has shown us. Mumia was the only journalist who gave any fair ground to Mu, especially with the trial of 9 Mu defendants stemming from August 8, 1978. So that same loyalty and uncompromising commitment that our brother has shown toward us, we've been showing toward him and fighting for his release. And we haven't given up this fight yet, and we're not going to until our brother's home.
And of course, solidarity and reserve are what's needed if the upcoming prison strike is to be effective.
Yes, sir. Like, when do you say enough is enough? August 21st, on the anniversary of what I would believe would be the 48th anniversary of the assassination of prison leader and former Black Panther Field Marshal George Jackson. You know, they're calling for a nationwide strike in the prison system across the country for better conditions across the board. And this will run from August 21st through sometime in September, on September 7th, the anniversary of the Attica Rebellion. So we ask people in different areas to get in touch with mass incarceration groups that's working, doing solidarity and support work, because, you know, we have to be there for these brothers and sisters locked up on the inside. You know, they're separated from us by such a distance, and we have to be that vocal voice on our side for support for them. So this is very important to people who support the men and women involved in this nationwide prison strike.
What kind of lessons have been learned in the wake of the series of strikes that we've witnessed in terms of how to make them more effective and get more people on the outside involved?
What type of lesson? Well, I mean, we've learned several lessons from it, far as solidarity, far as the work, you know, better communication, better outreach, you know, learning how to keep the pressure on elected officials in those areas and out here, different state senators. We have a nationwide movement around the issue of mass incarceration. We have built so much solidarity. It's like a tidal wave getting bigger and bigger and bigger to where all of this work has forced the issue. Look at Pennsylvania, the issue of juvenile lifers, how young men and women that were sentenced as teens to life in prison are now being released. Look how the complexion of the parole board in New York State is changing to where, because of the work of people in the prison and outside of the prison on this parole issue, how the complexion of the parole board is changing and men and women across New York State are starting to be paroled. But look how they're admitting in California there's overcrowding in the prisons and how they're starting to release elderly prisoners based on this work that the men and women on the inside is doing and men and women here on the outside is doing on this issue of mass incarceration. Like I said, the tidal wave is getting bigger and bigger, and we're about to wash this issue off the shore altogether.
So you say things are moving on up for the prison abolition movement.
Things are moving up. This system is being exposed. They are being backed into a corner, and they are being pressured to do right, because this system has no interest in doing right by people. They have to be forced to do right. And that's what Mu's founder, John Africa, teaches. And they're being put in a position now where they're being forced to do the right thing. And we're going to keep the pressure on them over these issues.
But the impression that one gets is that inside the prison, the conditions of incarceration are such that it becomes harder and harder to organize.
Well, yes, a lot of men and women, they're scared to organize because fear of reprisal, you know, fear of losing their so-called privileges, fear of being put in solitary, fear of being transferred even further from your family. And that's understandable, but that stuff is going to happen either way, whether you take in a stand or whether you not. I mean, George Jackson was persecuted for taking a stand in the prison. You know, you had a brother here in New York State, a Chinese immigrant. His name was David Wong. He was sent to prison on a false robbery charge in the 80s, sent to Clinton Correctional Facility in New York, could hardly speak English, anything. He wasn't a prison organizer or a prison abolitionist, but he was set up and framed for the murder of another inmate by guards itself. So you see, this has nothing to do with if you're a revolutionary, if you're speaking out, or you're an organizer. This has nothing to do with it at all. So you might as well stand up and take a stand against something. You know, whether it's the lack of food that you're getting when they feed you, the unhealthy food, or the abuse of solitary, the limitation of visits, whatever it is. Prisons is not right, period. And they didn't have corrections in mind when they built these places. They had enslavement in mind. And prison ain't nothing but a new word or a new tactic for enslavement. That's all it is.
And of course, the Move family has seen a recent victory with the release of one of your members. What's next on the calendar in terms of getting folks free?
All right. Well, like I said, our sister Debbie Africa came home this June after 39 years. She was one of the first of the Move 9 to be paroled. So next, we have our brother Michael Africa Sr. He's coming up for parole in September. And from there, Chuck Africa's coming up in November. So people can go to www.onamove.com for more information. www.onamove.com for more information about the parole and what people can do. Like we said, we have two more parole hearings coming up this year, one in January and two in May for two of our sisters. And we're still waiting on the parole appeal for our brother Delbert Africa, but there'll be more information to follow what people can do. But again, they can go to www.onamove.com to get involved. And we want to say again, we're happy our sister Debbie's home, but we still got work to do to bring the rest of the Move 9 home, to bring Jaleel Muntakim home, Sundiata Okole home. You know, and we want to welcome home our brothers Robert Seth Hayes and Herman Bell, two New York State political prisoners that was in prison for over 40 years that just made it at the board and came home this year as well. So we want to say on the move and welcome home to these two freedom fighting brothers. The thing that's burning up my throat is the fact that Mumia is still in prison. That thing, the evidence, there's been overwhelming evidence showing the innocence of our brother and why he should be released. That's what's burning in my throat. And again, I urge people from all over to come out on Thursday, August 30th, 2018, in Philadelphia. You can go to the website, www.freemomia.com, or you can go to Google, www.mobilizationformomia. You can Google that to get information on August 30th. But we need people from all around to come out, because this fight for Mumia, it just isn't for Mumia. It's for all of us to be free. With that, I like to say on the move and to keep up the fight.
That was prison abolition activist Ori Lumumba. From his place of incarceration in Pennsylvania, Mumia Abu-Jamal files this prison radio report on the passing of one of the greats of Black American culture.
With one unmistakable name, a musical legend was born. Aretha. Born on March 25, 1942. In Memphis, Tennessee, raised in Detroit, daughter of the famous gospel preacher Reverend Cecil L. Franklin. She was born to a world made and moved by music. Her father taught her timing and phrasing, But the precocious Aretha learned young that her voice, with its incessant, pure, ascendant tone, could topple walls and open hearts. It took her to the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame in 1987, and at least five of her many top hits have since become classics. Respect, I Never Loved a Man, Freeway of Love, Share Your Love with Me, and Something He Can Feel. In her matchless career, she had 20 number one hits, from Respect and I Never Loved a Man in 1967 to Freeway of Love, the summer 1985. Her fans, though, loved her like family, and it didn't really matter where she was on the charts. She sang with utter, moving, emphatic emotion and captured hearts near and far. Her voice, her gift, rang like a bell in the night. But she didn't only shine on stage. During a recent interview, she described herself as a domestic goddess. And what job is harder than raising black children in America? As black mother, she was indeed a goddess, reigning over the rhythms of life and love at home in Detroit. For a black woman to go from the Jim Crow South to become a queen of the kingdom of music, and then a goddess at home, is no small thing. She was, is, and shall ever be Aretha, who lightened and enriched the hearts of millions around the world. She returns to the celestial choir after 76 summers of earthly life. From Imprisoned Nation, this is Mumia Abu-Jamal.
You've been listening to the Black Agenda Report on the Progressive Radio Network. Information for liberation.